thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
I've got a grade.
Here's John Williams.
And you did it. This is John. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue, here till 3, Saturdays 10 to noon.
Lord have mercy.
And we've changed my social media handles. So if you want to follow me on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook, either way, it's WGN King John. I don't know if that's going to affect your following me already. Violetta assures me that it will not. But if you want to follow me on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter, just type in WGN King John, and there you will find the John Williams Show page, or account, or feed. Yesterday, on the show and on Facebook, we said, listen, grade the president's speech, the State of the Union address. I'm just reporting back to you the final results on that. And it's a mixed bag, but I thought it was interesting, and I just want to say this. As we were going through the text to the show and the Facebook stuff, I started tallying them. The overall grade the president got, the last I checked, if we averaged them all in, was a C plus B minus. I gave him a B minus myself. The Mincing Rascals in our weekly podcast we just recorded, a collection of conservative and liberal commentators. I think we were all about a B minus, C plus on it as well. So it seems like everybody sort of thinks he did pretty good. I know that a very high percentage of Americans approve of the speech, although a very high percentage of Americans always approve of the State of the Union address. So Trump didn't break any records, but he didn't fall. And I think that's a victory for all of us when he can deliver a nice speech like he did. Anyway, the first 30 or so texts come in and score A through F. 13 gave him an A, 13 gave him an F. And the rest of them were in between. But I guess that's not surprising. That's the definition of polarization. Very, very high. 13 people said A. The next 13 people say an F. And there's some in between. But that's kind of the way it went. Average them out, and there you are, around a C plus or a B minus for the president's speech on Monday, on Tuesday. Today is Thursday. A little later on, we'll visit with the director of the Center for Immigration Studies. Now, you've heard about chain migration, and I don't think we're supposed to call it that anymore. Maybe we are, but some people are put off by that. The visa lottery system, the wall, and how all these things tie together. We'll talk about that a little later on. That's after 1:30. And as soon as the president decides to release the Nunes memo, that's what we'll be talking about. So stay tuned. If the president decides this afternoon, Steve, do we have a timeline on that? Do we know what he's going to do, or when the president is going to release the Nunes memo?
Well, I don't think he is. The last I heard was that the White House put a few redactions
right.
in.
Yeah.
And then they're sending it back to the House Judiciary Committee.
Okay.
Which would then release it. So it gives them gives the White House a little cover, because they're saying, well, we didn't release it. We put our changes on it, and I don't know how serious the changes are.
Yeah. No, I think their stamp is on it either way. The White House could have said no, and obviously the Senate Judiciary Committee, voting on party lines, wants it released. So I get the feeling we're going to hear or see this thing, but we have not yet. If that happens before 3, you'll hear it here on WGN Radio. When I was watching the president's speech, I was sort of live tweeting, and some of them were, you know, just brilliant observations, and some of them were not. And some of them were things that I typed in, and it was a snarky little funny thing, and then I deleted it. I just wiped them out. And then you do this little debate with yourself. Oh, but that was so good. It was gold. It was gold. The world would love to see that. Maybe I'll get 20 likes. But maybe I won't. And then maybe people will go, hey, John, I thought you were better than this. And maybe I am better than this. So I do this whole internal dialogue. And I'd say 3 or 4 times during the president's speech, I chose not to send out to the world what I was thinking. It's perilous out there, especially if you're a public figure. And really, even if you're not, because that stuff can come around to haunt you. Witness the Illinois Lottery Control Board, whatever that is. But we have the Illinois Lottery, and there's a board that controls it, and there's a guy who was the chairman of it from Evanston, and he sent something out on Twitter the other day that had nothing to do with his job, but it was in poor enough taste that now he's been forced to resign. I guess Charlie Daniels tweeted something the other day. I'm picking it up now from the Peoria Journal Star. I also heard this story earlier today here on WGN Radio. Charlie Daniels tweeted, Mr. Durbin, he's writing to our Senator Dick Durbin, I'm so sorry. Durbin was offended by the president's use of that S-hole phrase. Mr. Durbin, said Charlie Daniels, I'm so sorry that your virgin ears were blistered by the absolutely horrible language President Trump used in front of you. Daniels tweeted this January 16th. The president actually thought he was addressing a meeting of members of Congress and not a kindergarten class. Hope you didn't wet your pants too, said Charlie Daniels to Dick Durbin. And then this chairman of the Illinois Lottery sees that, and so then he tweets to Charlie Daniels. How cool is that, that you can talk to a celebrity, a major star? You just tweet right at him. Charlie, he wrote, Durbin's hometown is, get this, East St. Louis, Illinois. The blank hole of the universe, just do a Google search. And that's somebody that you and I are paying to do a job for all of us.
And for the people of East St. Louis, Illinois.
Absolutely. And by the way, you're absolutely right, Steve. Good point. I mean, I'm in Chicago, right? But I wonder how the people in East St. Louis feel about that. One of their representatives, say, you know, he's not their state legislator, but I suppose if you're the Illinois Lottery Control Board chairman, you're working for all the people of Illinois. So he gone. He gone. And I wonder if when he sent that, that must have felt so clever, that must have felt so satisfying. It must have felt kind of empowering, because there you're rebuffing the House Minority Leader, the whip, the House whip. That's not the Minority Leader. Dick Durbin, is he the Minority Leader for the U.S. Senate? I said House, the Senate. He is the longest-serving Democrat in the Senate, isn't Dick Durbin?
No, I don't think so.
All right.
He's the second-ranking Democrat.
That makes him the whip, right?
Right.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, I'd look that up, but I'd be surprised if he's the second-longest-serving. Maybe he is.
Been there for a while. So there you can sort of rebuff him and talk to Charlie Daniels at the same time, and everybody will pat you on the back. And you'll lose your job. It's just funny how perilous those things are. Which leads me to another bizarre story, in my estimation today, of somebody who lost their job. This is from the Chicago Tribune. Noam Levy, who's been on with us many times, he's actually out of the LA Times, Los Angeles Times writer. He often writes about healthcare issues. Noam Levy is really good on healthcare issues. And so the Chicago Tribune printed his story today. CDC chief quits over tobacco stocks, other trading conflicts. Now, the head of the Center for Disease Control, it says here, Health and Human Services Secretary. So the Health and Human Services Secretary. Health and Human Services Secretary was Tom Price. Remember, Tom Price was forced to resign last year amid questions about his frequent use of charter aircraft at taxpayers' expense. They said, yeah, you shouldn't be doing that. And they had some defense about it, like what he was doing was vital to the national interest, and he had to fly first class or privately or whatever, or U.S. jets that he could have flown coach with the rest of us schlubs. And also when he was a congressman, he traded in healthcare companies, even as he was pushing legislation that may have affected those companies. So it was seen as a bit of a conflict of interest. Then he becomes Health and Human Service Secretary, and then he's misusing funds. And so they said, okay, we got to get rid of you. Now we have a director of the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, Dr. Brenda Fitzgerald. And it's been revealed that the woman who is in charge of the Center for Disease Control has been trading tobacco stocks in her portfolio. Among the companies whose stock Fitzgerald purchased last year after taking office were pharmaceutical giants Merck and Company, Bayer, and health insurer Humana, according to financial disclosures first reported by Politico, which in itself is a bit of a conflict of interest. If you're in any position to do anything that affects the outcome of these companies, then you probably shouldn't be involved on a personal level in their stocks. The stock in Japan Tobacco, A multinational that sells Winston and Camel cigarettes around the world was valued at between $1,000 and $15,000 in her portfolio. And when it was revealed that she has those, they asked her to step aside, and so I guess she has two. But, I mean, that's kind of an easy one. First of all, if you're a doctor, what are you doing with that anyway? I may have tobacco stocks in my portfolio, such as it is. That is, we have some mutual funds in our 401k, and maybe they're... maybe they include tobacco stocks. I don't even know. But if I was going to be the CDC head, I'd find out. And this makes it sound like she was trading specifically in those stocks. And if so, that's just like, how did they not vet that? And how did she not vet that? How did that not come up? One other thing that came up that the Mincing Rascals spoke about are weekly roundtable that we do. We just recorded it this morning, and we'll post it at about 5 o'clock this evening. It's a conversation this week with Eric Zorn, the Tribune columnist, with Kristen McQuarrie, the editorial writer, and Scott Stantis, the editorial cartoonist at the Tribune, Steve Bertrand and I. We kicked around a number of things. One thing we did not get to, and Zorn was kind of hoping we would, was the story of Marilyn Hartman, who we've been talking about, the stowaway on airplanes, not infrequently out of Chicago. She is from the Chicago area, for a while was living on the north side of the city. And she's in jail again, being held without bail after she was arrested Sunday. And Eric Zorn's point about her is, he said, I don't know what we should say about this, except isn't this a sad, sad story? What a sad case. You remember earlier this month, according to the Tribune's Megan Crapeau, Hartman got past British Airway ticket agents and a Customs and Border Protection officer, boarded a jet without a ticket, and flew to London's Heathrow Airport in an empty seat. She got very upset at her hearing in court the other day. It says Hartman has been detained several times across the country for trying to bypass airport security. I don't know what they're supposed to do, but I think they have to hold her against her will, either in a hospital or a jail. But she should not be let go, because she will go to an airport. The last time she was arrested, she wasn't on a plane. She was just at the airport moseying about. And they said, you can't be there. Somebody recognized her, and that violated the terms of her probation, so she got arrested again.
Well, what's the harm in, I mean, not that there's harm, but she should be caught by security. I mean, there's not a threat to the airplane if she sneaks on it, is it?
I think there may be.
All right, that's what I'm asking. So is it, what's the fair trade? To lock her up so that, because she might do harm to people on that plane?
I think so. Or just be so disruptive that it has to divert. Or who knows if she...
Or maybe she really needs help, and that's why she needs to be locked up.
For that, that's a given. I think this lady, it's sad, right? But for some reason, the voices in her head are saying, go to the airport and get on airplanes. And so she does. If they ever say, bring a screwdriver, then we're in trouble. But if they just, if she gets upset, if she gets unruly and it diverts or somehow compromises the safety on the flight, then you've got a whole nother problem. Besides, that nobody should be able to get on a plane without a ticket. I mean, I'm just amazed that this is this easy for this lady to do. So,
I mean, she's good to have security. That's one thing. Then they're supposed to check their boarding pass and a passport, right, at the gate?
Yeah. I mean, think of all the checks you go through to get on an airplane. The TSA, the shoe thing, the ticket agent.
Right, but I'm thinking she buys a ticket to anywhere for like $25, but then goes to the wrong flight.
So that gets her to the terminal, like Terminal A, Terminal C, and now she just hangs out and sneaks on, huh?
Right, or, oh, it's not scanning. Whoops.
But you couldn't see, you know, you
it sounds like a woman who's talked herself through a lot of things there, doesn't it?
In 1978, you could talk yourself into an airport. You can't now. I'd love to see how she does it. And it bothers me that she can. And it's not just her, but other people that could, but also her specifically. I don't think she should be allowed to roam freely. She's a danger, I think, to people at airports or on airplanes. We start with Gene. Gene, you're on WGN. Jump in here. Hi.
Hi. This isn't that an original thought, but at first I thought, you know, when this started years ago, I thought, how amusing. And then, of course, when you start to think about it, it's scary Because if she could do it, other people could do it.
That's what I'm thinking. I mean, that's...
And, you know, she's got such a pretty, benign, grandmotherly appearance. She could be in permanent extra in movies because she just kind of blends in.
You know, Gene, that's an interesting point. Thank you for the call. But I think we have this image of, we've all profiled, like it or not, what we think a terrorist or a dangerous person will look like. And I'll bet for most of us, Marilyn is not what that is, not the image that comes to mind. You know, I guess that is also a reminder that that's not foolproof, is it? Where do we go next there, Ms. Garris? We go to Patrick. You're on WGN. Hi, Pat. You're on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to say she could just be put in jail for theft of services.
I was wondering about that. I mean, they were saying, like, she's violating the terms of this and that. And I go, no, you. If you fly to London and you don't have a ticket, then you owe somebody, like, $4,000, don't you?
Yeah, and that's like grand larceny. And if you do that three times, that's like a, you know, third strike law. She's done this a lot. She should, if the airlines press charges, she should be in jail.
Thank you for the call. From there we go to Leo. This all sounds so inconsiderate to this little old lady who's not well, but these are the facts. Hey, Leo, you're on the air.
Hi, John. John, I wanted to comment. There's no other place that has more cameras than a casino. But we know from visiting the airport that there's a tremendous amount of cameras everywhere. And I want to know, why isn't the airport supplying the media of how this woman got through security? Because I know when I go through security, there's usually some TSA acting like a drill sergeant, take your laptops out of your bags and do this and do that, be prepared to go, just like a drill sergeant.
No.
And I don't know how this one lady, and I understand no one suspects an older lady to do any harm, but with the technology that Hollywood supplies, makeup can make anybody look like somebody else.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, I hope they know how she's doing it. We don't. I don't. But I hope they do. And I hope it's instructive to them some way. One real quick call from Leo, then we'll break for the news. Hey, Leo, you're on the air.
She's doing it. We don't. I don't.
Ed. Hey, Ed, are you there?
Yeah.
Talk to me. You're on the radio. This is John.
Okay. I fly a lot. And, you know, they're scanning the passport or the boarding pass. And that should match up with what their flight is and so forth. But then every time I know it, before they take off, the people are coordinating with the people outside, the stewardess, and they come up with a count. So to me, their count would have to be off.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't even know how they take off. How, really, they know how many. That's right. They walk down, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And if they're one.
And then the people from outside.
I know, if the number's one higher than the number of people they're supposed to have, we don't take off now. All of this is unsettling to me, Ed. Thank you for the call. It's 129. What were you going to say?
Gwen also called in the beginning and said she thinks she has Alzheimer's.
Yeah, well, this lady may. I don't know what she has, but the bigger problem is not about her. It's about us and the system.
But see, then what you're arguing is that you want to lock her up for something she might do. She hasn't done harm or committed violence or anything like that. You want to lock her up because she might get through again and she might, if for the first time ever, do something to cause harm to someone on one of those planes.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
A single immigrant can bring in virtually unlimited numbers of distant relatives. Under our plan, we focus on the immediate family by limiting sponsorships to spouses and minor children.
A part of the president's State of the Union address taught us two things. One is something about how chain migration works or might work, and two, that Americans don't really know how to hiss. But never mind that second part. Let's talk about the first. Jessica Vaughn is the director of the Center for Immigration Studies. She joins us from Washington, D.C. to tell us a little bit about what the president said and what it all means. Hi, Jessica. It's John Williams. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Good to be with you.
You know, I suppose you have a dog in this hunt. I suppose you're an advocate for one side on this. But before we get to that, I wonder if you could just answer a few nuts and bolts questions for me about immigration in this country and how it works. Specifically about that, about family reunification or chain migration. What is that, and how does it currently work in this country?
Chain migration is the process of immigrants coming here who were sponsored by family members who came before them. It's that simple.
And who? You know, so if I'm here and I want to sponsor a family member, can I sponsor anybody? How do we define family?
Under our law, people can sponsor certain relatives that are set out in the law, and that's specifically if they get married after they've come here. Now, immigrants can bring their immediate family with them when they get their green card. If they get married after they get their green card, then they can sponsor that spouse and that spouse's children. When they become citizens, they can sponsor their own children who are adults, and if those sons and daughters are married, they can bring those kids. They can sponsor their parents, and they can sponsor their siblings and the family of their siblings.
So my kids, my grandkids, my parents. I didn't hear you say nieces and nephews, but I could.
Well, that would be the kids of your siblings.
Siblings, so I could bring my nieces and nephews. So really, pretty much everything right. that I would define as my nuclear or even the second tier of my family, I could invite, I could sponsor. Would they automatically, by virtue of that, be able to come into this country, or would there still be a waiting process for them?
Well, some of the categories, there is no wait. For example, spouses and parents, there is no wait. They come in unlimited numbers. And those are the biggest categories of chain migration. For the other categories, there are waiting times, and they're different depending on which country people are coming from. So Congress has imposed numerical limits that we call the per-country cap, so that if a country has more people interested and on the waiting list for the limited number of visas, then it's a slower process. For certain countries like Mexico, the Philippines, India, and a few others, they have longer waits because Congress didn't want the flow of immigration to be dominated by a handful of countries. They wanted to open it up to everyone on a more level playing field.
It's kind of an interesting question. Right. I mean, if say a lot of people from India and Mexico, just to pick two, want to come to this country, we're going to put a cap on that because we're only going to let so many people in, and we don't want them all to be from Mexico and India. We want to let Luxembourg and Nigeria have a crack at it too, right?
Right.
Yeah. Then at any point in along this way, do we say, okay, who has the highest education, who can do the most benefit for this country?
Not in the family categories. They're strictly based on family relationships. We do have other categories of immigration, though, that are based on skills in education or accomplishment, and there is no limit. The limit is 140,000, but we never reach that. Every year, about 20,000 people come in that category. And we also have categories for people who are sponsored by employers. These are also skills-based. They have to have at least a college education or the equivalent number of years of experience. And those are heavily oversubscribed also, and there's a waiting list in those categories probably of at least 500,000 people.
Back to chain migration. Chain migration, it's okay to use that phrase in your estimation? That's not a slur of any kind?
I don't think it's a slur at all because it simply refers to the process and kind of gives a visual appearance of, you know, continued links in the chain of family members. And it's been used for many years by researchers and policy experts to describe this process.
So if I'm fortunate enough to become a citizen of the United States from, say, Mexico, if I'm married and have kids, then and they all get to come right away. So it's not just one person that's in. It may be 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever. And one more time. And then my parents would be able to come as well, correct?
Once the immigrant, become a U.S. citizen, then you are eligible to sponsor your parents.
I see. And then maybe the waiting time is a little bit longer, depending on how further out you expand the family. And then what is the lottery? Can you explain the lottery system to us for countries or individuals?
Yes, that's a separate category that was created in 1990 to create a process for immigration for countries that up to then had not sent many immigrants to the United States. Originally, actually, it was a pilot program designed to legalize mainly Irish illegal immigrants who had not qualified for the 1986 amnesty. But after that, it was made permanent and opened up to all the rest of the world. And since then, these 50,000 visas a year have been given out on the basis of a random lottery. It's been very popular in certain parts of the world, but it also, unfortunately, has been, there's been a lot of fraud in the program, and it's difficult to administer in a way that can prevent the fraud.
Tell me about that.
It has been in our law for a while.
What is the fraud? I mean, how does that work?
Well, there have been instances of criminal organizations. In one case in Eastern Europe, for example, they hacked the identity card database of a university and submitted applications for every student at the university because they had their pictures, their date of birth, and all their biographic information. And then inevitably, you can imagine, with thousands of applicants, some of them did win. And so they staked out the post office and intercepted the winning notifications and then went to those students and tried to coerce them into, accepting this offer and going to the United States. And, they gave them pop-up spouses to go with them. And when they got to the United States, they made them continue to work for the organization to sort of pay them back.
Wow.
There are others who sell their winning tickets. It's been a problem for the State Department for many years.
All of this sort of begs the question, though, who do we want to let in? For instance, in principle, the lottery thing sounds a little bit like the Statue of Liberty. Bring us your tired and weary and we'll be an oasis for them. That's a true American ideal. The fraud notwithstanding, I think some people are even questioning that, including the president, who thinks that's way too random. It's designed to be random. It's not based on skills or merit, right?
That's right. I mean, you have to have completed a certain number of years of high school or have some experience, but all of that is very easy to fabricate for people. Essentially, if you win, you're pretty much going to be in unless you're a criminal or a terrorist.
All right, this is interesting. Now, you may have a question about these 2 points or maybe another aspect, the four pillars, one of which is the wall. For Jessica Vaughn, she's the director of the Center for Immigration Studies. Call me right now. We'll pick that up here in just a minute. And I wonder, what do you make of these four pillars and what should happen next, Jessica? 312-981-7200. John Williams on WGN Radio. You should call me right now. President Trump visited with Republicans today and reviewed his State of the Union address. What did he tell them? Coming up at 2, it's 1:52 here on WGN. I'm John Williams, and we're talking to Jessica Vaughn. She's the director of the Center for Immigration Studies. She's in Washington, D.C. We're asking her about some of the points the president made about chain migration, about the lottery system, about the wall, about the four pillars, and we're learning a little bit about how that system works. By the way, Jessica, so you've described to us some of these legs, if you will. How would it change? What would be the most dramatic change if the president gets his way on all of this?
Well, we've been talking about these different kinds of immigration, and Congress has always sought to have a balance between the obvious wanting to let people bring their family members when they immigrate here, and also the other obvious, which is humanitarian admissions, and another, wanting to bring people with skills and education. That has all gotten out of balance over time because largely the fastest growing category, it has been chain migration, which is, and because some of those categories allow people to bring in their family members in unlimited numbers. So the president's plan uses the opportunity of doing an amnesty and passing legislation to make some long overdue changes in our law. So one would be, the first pillar is a path to citizenship for about 2 million of the so-called dreamers who arrived as children. And offsetting that with cuts to chain migration, because any amnesty means that there will be a growth in legal immigration downstream.
Yeah.
And also cutting the visa lottery, because that's probably the most, for lack of a better word, extraneous category of immigration that we have that's not, you know, as compelling as, say, refugees or family members. And then lastly, boosting border security and immigration enforcement so that on its own merits, because there are real needs there, but also to avoid setting off a new wave of future illegal immigration inspired by this big amnesty. So it's really not just standalone elements. It's pretty much a package of things that work together to try to improve our immigration system and deal with this issue of the people who arrived as kids.
Do you have anything to say about the surveillance along the borders, either a wall or higher surveillance along the border?
Well, I think both of them are useful in different ways. There are places where unquestionably a barrier would be very helpful to the Border Patrol because it slows down the, you know, the entry of people. But that only works in places where it can be patrolled, and surveillance is also very helpful in places that where there are not huge numbers of people crossing and the conditions are very extreme and the Border Patrol can't get to. Sometimes it's good to just, you know who's coming across so that you can send someone to apprehend them at a different point. So they both work.
I wonder if you would prioritize these things. Should we absolutely have the wall? I mean, that's got to be a deal breaker. Or can we do that a different way or at a later date? Is the chain migration thing maybe most critical? What's your thought about all of that?
Well, honestly, I think that the two pillars that make the most sense together are the amnesty for at least some of the Dreamers paired with cuts to chain migration to offset those numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I think that makes the most sense because if we're going to give out a lot of new green cards, we ought to look at trimming them in other areas for the reason that immigration has had a disadvantage for Americans who are competing for those very same opportunities with the people who are going to be getting the amnesty and a lot of the future immigrants. So there are, you know, people who are struggling, who for whatever reason haven't had a lot of higher education, who are working in jobs where they have not seen much of a pay increase over the years, like construction and food processing and landscaping. A lot of these jobs are also taken by illegal immigrants or new immigrants. There needs to be some relief for them as well. And so I think this is a balanced approach that the president has put forward. I think the amnesty he's offering is a little bit too many people. I think the chain migration cuts need to come sooner rather than later. But he's trying to get something through the Senate where there are a lot of different views on immigration. So mm-hmm. I understand his approach and that a compromise is necessary.
You know, you mentioned landscapers. I guess a lot of us could relate to any number of populations of people we've worked with or have hired. Say you've had a landscaper come out, and it's a crew of guys who speak marginal English, and you wonder about their citizenship, but you don't want to look too close because they're doing a good job and they don't charge you as much as some other guys. I wonder what would happen if we minimized that population, and I presume so that people who are already here and are, in fact, U.S. citizens, will be able to get those jobs. Would the cost of those jobs, would my landscaping bill go up as a result?
Well, it might. I probably would. But on the other hand, all of us pay the cost as taxpayers or healthcare consumers when a landscape worker who is paid under the table and can't get workman's comp if he or she is hurt or, you know, doesn't have health insurance, has those needs and goes to the hospital and is treated in the emergency room. And that's something that we as taxpayers cover for these employers who have this business model of hiring illegal workers because they're cheaper for the employer. So there's a social cost and a greater fiscal cost to looking the other way at that kind of an employment arrangement.
Mm-hmm. And one other thing.
And it would, you know, to pay them a little bit more wouldn't be that much more of a cost overall for clients or for taxpayers.
Do you think that any of these measures would make us safer from crime?
You mean the amnesty or cuts in chain migration? No, I don't think that public safety is really the driving argument there. That certainly is an argument in favor of better border security.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if we don't know, if we can't get a better handle on border security, then we are, you know, feeling the effects of drug trafficking, human smuggling, you know, all kinds of other illicit
activities. Right, but my understanding is that the per capita U.S. citizens commit more crimes than immigrants or even illegal immigrants.
Well, I've studied this issue for many years, and I don't see any evidence whatsoever that immigrants commit more or less crimes than American citizens or any other subgroup. And you know, I don't think that question is really relevant to the discussion. I mean,
well, then you didn't hear the State of the Union address, because that was the president was terrifying us with horrible stories of people committing crimes who have come here, and by God, we've got to stop it. Otherwise, more of these people's kids are going to get killed. I'll let you respond to that.
We can deny that there are immigrants who do commit crimes, and that's really the issue, is what do we do with that small fraction of the immigrant population that has committed crimes, that have come here and are terrorizing immigrant communities? That's is a real problem, and for that we need to enforce our immigration laws.
Jessica Vaughn's the director of the Center for Immigration Studies. She's in Washington, D.C. We're in Chicago, where it just beeped 2 o'clock. I got to get to my news, Jessica. I'm really glad you were able to join us today.
Thanks so much for having me. Enjoyed it.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have
Not
to.
Not even close.
Here's John Williams.
John, how are you? Mm-hmm. You try it and see how easy it is. It's 2:09. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue.
Lord have mercy.
And it's lovely outside. Blue skies, breezy though. Flags are flapping and folks are bundled up. And it's getting cold outside. Not as cold as it is at the Super Bowl home. I got friends in Minnesota, you know, near family up there. It's single digits. I woke up this morning, it was 25. I got up real early today, it was 25. It was 3 there. Ha! So it could be worse. It's an article in Time magazine, and I thought it was pretty interesting. It said, here are 8 weight loss strategies that actually work. So I don't know where you are on your New Year regimen, but the first one just jumped out at me. Eat a big breakfast.
I'm listening.
I'm like, you know what? And I don't. I hardly eat all day. I'll sometimes only eat one meal a day, and that's dinner. I know I'm upside down. I'm terrible, terrible, bad, bad, bad. But I'm not hungry in the morning. And I thought, well, I need to eat anyway and get into that habit, because I got out of the habit of eating during the day. It just was inconvenient, and then I found myself not being hungry during the day. I'll bet I could reverse engineer that and just start eating in the morning until I got hungry in the morning.
So what's a big breakfast?
For me?
No, I mean, what
for
are they
the article.
Oh, yeah, I guess. Pardon me, I was there.
Well, I start off with some Cheerios and then a banana.
It says here, Steve, there's more proof that breakfast may be the healthiest meal of the day. A recent study in The Place found that people who skip it are more likely to be overweight and to have dangerous plaque. Researchers analyzed the breakfast habit of a bunch of folks between 40 and 50 who lived in Spain. Some people skipped in the morning meal entirely, but most ate low-calorie fare like toast or small pastries. Others ate heartier breakfasts that comprised 20% of their daily calories, more than that. People who skipped or skimped on breakfast were more likely to have signs of plaque, folks that ate more. It doesn't say here exactly what a big old breakfast would be.
I wake up starving.
So would you say 20% of your calories?
Or more.
I probably do that.
Should come at breakfast time.
Steve, what do you eat for breakfast?
I make it every night before I go to bed. I make two lightly scrambled eggs. The key is that they not be overly cooked.
Wow.
And put them over a bed of arugula or spinach with a little olive oil.
And you cook that at night?
I've never heard of that.
And then you eat it when?
Well, in the morning.
Well, but how much work does it take to do it in the morning?
I get up very early in the morning.
You're reheating eggs that you scrambled the night before?
I come here.
Yeah?
Judgy man. And I pop them in the microwave for about 30 seconds. But if you undercook them a little, then they cook just right. Trust me, I'm very happy with my breakfast.
I'm not.
While we're doing this, sorry to peek the microphone there. I also would like to share my favorite breakfast.
Which is?
It's a cereal that I get from Mariano's, and they're square-shaped. It's called Cracklin' Oat Bran.
Got it.
That's crackling with an apostrophe at the end. And then I pile on some...
Thank you, Governor. We appreciate that.
The others, yes.
You're welcome. And then I pile on the strawberries and raspberries.
That sounds pretty dang healthy.
Well, really? Okay, I have eggs and arugula or spinach.
In the microwave from the night before.
She has processed cereal, and you talk about hers being healthier.
That's true, though. I mean, but maybe that's the problem with us. That is, like, to me, when I do eat breakfast, and sometimes I do, it depends on if we have Raisin Nut Bran. If we have Raisin Nut Bran, that's what I have, with some milk and coffee. I'll drink a half a pot of coffee and eat Raisin Nut Bran in the morning. And I like that, but I feel it's kind of like taking medicine. Like, all right, I'll do this because I think it's good for me. And I'm not so sure it is. all right, let's get some expert opinion on all of this. Linda Van Horn joins us, Chief of Nutrition. She is a professor of preventative medicine over at the Feinberg School at Northwestern. Now, she wasn't the author of this timepiece. Some journalists were, but we asked an expert to review it for us, and she said she would. Linda, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, and thanks for asking. It's a very important discussion you're having.
What's your editorial comment about our observations about breakfast?
Well, I think you're all on target in one way or another, and I thought I should first start, though, by saying that a big breakfast does not necessarily mean thousands of calories. It's said in the article 20% or so of your total calories for the day should come from breakfast. So more than 5%, which would be maybe a glass of juice or something like that, which some people call breakfast, but more along the lines of what all three of you were actually mentioning. And each of them have their positive values. So good job.
Well, there has been an argument the last few years about should we load up on eggs and bacon, that the American Cancer Society has misrepresented the danger of that, or the American Heart Association, that's not so bad for us. So some of us have gone to toast and cereal, carbohydrate heavy, which I've been told is a terrible decision. We should eat bacon and eggs. What do you think about that?
Well, let's just start with bacon. There is absolutely no evidence anywhere suggesting that bacon is healthy for you. Bacon is loaded with saturated fat and nitrates and sodium, and it really is not a health food.
But it's so good.
I know.
And we understand that. So, you know, certainly if the rest of your lifestyle is healthy, a little bacon, if life is just not life without it for you, you certainly can accommodate. The confusion came, frankly, when the 2015 U.S. Dietary Guidelines said that, quote, dietary cholesterol is no longer a nutrient of concern, unquote. And dietary cholesterol is primarily found in the American diet in eggs. And the comment about no longer a nutrient of concern really, in nutrition speak, means that America's doing pretty darn well consuming the recommended amount or the limit in under 300 milligrams per day.
So it's not that they changed their opinion. It's just that we're doing a good job not overeating them.
Exactly. So, you know, the idea of not consuming excessive amounts of eggs. Eggs are perfectly fine, nutritious, healthy source of protein, etc. But this does not give one license to just, you know, overeat on bacon and eggs. It's just not the healthiest choice as far as breakfast is concerned.
I want to run through these other seven items and get your observations about them. But just one last question about eat a big breakfast. I read that to mean, but also eat a smaller dinner. Should I make that trade if I was going to eat more somewhere, eat it in the morning, not in the evening?
Yeah, I think, you know, for someone who doesn't eat all day, which is a very common habit that many, many Americans follow, the tendency then is to overeat in the evening. Mm-hmm. And, of course, then you wake up not hungry because you've overeaten the night before. The other problem with missing breakfast is that typically is the way most people get dietary fiber and healthy whole grains and things of that sort that were being mentioned by, you know, a couple of you. And so by eliminating that meal, frequently that means you're not eating enough dietary fiber and often missing out on fruit. So, you know, to try to switch that around a bit and eat more in the morning and a little less at night would definitely be beneficial overall.
That sounds like really good advice because you're right. At night, I don't have a whole wheat toast or double fiber toast, and I don't have peaches or strawberries. Mm-hmm. I am inclined to eat those in the morning. So thank you for mentioning that. Number two in Time Magazine, 8 weight loss strategies that actually work. Drink one less soda a week, and you might see a pound or two a year come off. What do you make of that?
Well, there are actually data in children, adolescents, in fact, to document that. Simply by eliminating one sugar-sweetened beverage a week, children where we have a serious problem with pediatric obesity were able to lose weight without changing anything else.
Hmm.
Among adults, frankly, I see absolutely no reason why most adults should be consuming sugar-sweetened beverages. Most of us get far more calories than we need, and that's simply a source of calories with absolutely no nutritional benefit whatsoever.
When I decide to drink a sweet beverage, a carbonated beverage, a Coke versus a Pepsi or a Diet Coke, I don't know at the end of the day which is better for me. If I am going to have a can of soda, should I get the sugar sweetened soda or should I get the diet soda? Overall health impact.
That's a real difficult question to answer quickly because there's some evidence looking at something called the microbiome. I'm not sure if you're aware of that, but we have all these little microbes in our gut that are useful in terms of helping or harming our overall nutrition. And there is some evidence that suggests that the non-caloric sweeteners are actually worse than consuming sugar. So both are not a good choice. Better to drink water or even unsweetened coffee or carbonated soda water with some fruit juice in it or fresh fruit in it. Those are better choices certainly for an adult.
Number three in this piece from Time said, eat like an Italian. They talk about the Italian diet and the Mediterranean diet. If I was going to emulate somebody in the world, the Japanese come to mind. They live a real long time, too. Who should I eat like, would you say?
Well, certainly the data are very evident related to the Mediterranean diet lately. There's just been a lot of research done on that population. But as we all know, the Mediterranean encompasses a huge variety. Spain is one of those countries. Greece is another one of those countries, etc. So selective consumption of food from those regions certainly suggests there are many health benefits in terms of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, fish,
olive oil.
Right. Red wine. The difference between, for example, the Mediterranean diet and the DASH diet is the Italians would advocate red wine. The DASH diet advocates non-fat dairy, skim milk, and things like that. So it's, you know, most of us eat somewhere in between those two, and both are in the right direction.
If you have a choice to use olive oil or butter or something like that, you, I presume, should always go with olive oil if you can?
Absolutely.
And how does coconut oil play into that?
I'm so sorry to tell you, but coconut oil is 98% saturated fat.
Okay, so just throw that out.
Yeah. If you want to rub it on your body, fine, but don't put it in your mouth.
Wow, I hadn't heard that. How about peanut oil?
Peanut oil is also a monounsaturated fat like olive oil, but olive oil is a better of the two in terms of its total fatty acid content.
There were eight, I thought, just really intriguing, simple to manage suggestions. And there are three of them in Time magazine. Eat a bigger breakfast, maybe, than you are. Eat a smaller dinner. Drink one less soda per week. She said, you be the judge about the sugar versus non-sugar. She's not liking you having either. Eat like a Mediterranean or an Italian, say. But there's a few others as well. And you may have a question or comment as well. The number is 312-981-7200. We noticed an article in Time magazine had eight easy ways to lose weight. Are you thinking about that now that February is here? Linda Van Horn is the chief nutritionist and a professor of preventative medicine over at the Feinberg School at Northwestern University. At 2:25, a few more questions from our listeners and points from Time magazine for you to comment on, Linda. John, ask her about peanut butter and jelly. What do you make of PBJs?
Well, I think that peanut butter is an excellent source of plant-based protein. And if you put that on a whole grain piece of bread, you have a complete protein there. So the jelly I would go light on because that's pure sugar. But if you have a low-sugar version or just spreadable fruit, that combination is just fine and an inexpensive, easy way to get good source of protein.
Hey, John, I'm seeing a nutritionist now, and the nutritionist I'm seeing said breakfast like a king, lunch like a duke, dinner like a pauper, big, medium, small. Would you agree with that generally?
Yes. I think that has been the rule of thumb for many, many years. And if we could try to convince everyone to switch to that type of eating, I think we really would be better off.
Back to Time magazine's eight ways to lose weight. Number four, exercise to keep the weight off. They remind us that on Biggest Loser, it's dieting as well as exercise. You're going to lose the weight, they said, generally by dieting. Keeping it off, that's the work of exercise. Overall, maintainers did an average of 80 minutes of moderate exercise or 35 minutes of vigorous exercise each day, at least from that TV show. Well, most of us ain't going to do that. What do you say?
Well, I think exercise is an incredibly important component, and the most important thing is the habit, the behavior. Even if all you do is walk around the block, the main goal is to just keep busy, keep active each day for whatever time you have to commit to it. Once you get into that habit, it really is something that you look forward to, and it is for sure a great way of keeping weight off. If you don't put the calories in, your chances of keeping them off and not having the weight gain accompanying that certainly is goal number one. But to maintain that weight loss, physical activity can definitely benefit that process.
If you're going for that walk, even a brisk walk, though, maybe you're not getting your heart up to a certain rate. Does that concern you? And will I still be burning calories, losing weight, or maintaining if I go at a moderate pace?
The LSD, long, steady distance, is considered to be the best approach for most people who are middle-aged or overweight. It's a means of just maintaining that physical activity at a rate that is comfortable and allows you to keep going longer. High-intensity workouts are very popular right now, but for people who are not in tip-top shape, there's no question that extending that physical activity at a lower pace for a longer time is going to benefit that individual more than 5 minutes of high intensity with nothing else the rest of the day.
Time magazine's eight reasons or ways to lose weight in the new year. Get a good night's sleep is number five. Eat more slowly is number six. And get rid of fake sugars is number seven. Any general observations about those points?
Yeah, all of them are very important, and for reasons you can imagine. If you sleep more, you tend to be less tired, and therefore you tend to crave less of those high sugar foods that people run for when they're tired and fatigued. So sleeping as opposed to eating a candy bar certainly makes a lot more sense. The fake sugar issue is one that we discussed earlier, related to perhaps adverse impact on the microbiome. Those microbes that are healthy for us are confused when you consume an artificially sweetened beverage, and we still don't know exactly what the mechanisms are, but it's better to do without them. So those are, you know, for sure good things. And then again, just trying to regulate the overall intake of food throughout the day, and eating more slowly will happen if you're not starving. So for the person who doesn't eat all day, sitting down to a meal, it takes at least 20 minutes for your brain to actually recognize that you've been eating food and have been digesting it. And I know many people can overeat in less than 20 minutes before they really realize that they're full. So slowing it down, drinking more water in between, and just eating more regularly so you're not starving, all add up to a healthier lifestyle.
You're terrific, Linda. I really appreciate your time this afternoon. I sure hope you can join us again another day.
Oh, my pleasure. I would look forward to it.
Linda Van Horn is a professor and chief nutritionist over at the Feinberg School at Northwestern. In a minute, we'll talk to a reporter from ABC, Kenneth Moten, who is in Washington, about the decision by the president, I guess, to release the Nunes memo.
Yeah, so it was going back and forth today where they said there might be some minor redactions. They'd send it to the House, the committee, and now the New York Times and others saying that. I think the White House just put out a statement saying they would send it back and maybe nothing taken out of it. So, we'll see. It's going to be a big Friday.
We went back and forth on this in the Mincing Rascals podcast. If you listen to any podcast, we hope that you will add this. If you don't, make it your first one. It's called The Mincing Rascals. It's a half hour with Eric Zorn, Kristen McQuarrie, and editorial cartoonist Scott Stantis, all from the Chicago Tribune. Steve and I, we kick around various news stories. We really went at it over the Richard Roper Twitter count. We talked about Governor Rauner as well, and we talked about Joe Berrios locally. But a big conversation was scoring the president's speech and also this Nunes memo. And I thought that we would all be in concert, that it's reckless and political. We were not. Not everybody agreed with me on this one. Kristen and Scott were, you know what? This happens all the time. Why not let it see the light of day? I said, because it's a contained private investigation and this has never happened before.
That's the thing. It's hard because unless you really follow it and pay attention, and you got to figure out who to believe and all these anymore. But yeah, this is, and I'm sure Kenneth will tell you this, just how highly unusual this actual move is.
This goes back to that famous Steele dossier. Right? Why are you making
that? Well, it doesn't.
Up?
I did that to you in the podcast too.
I know. I don't know why you were derailing me. What am I getting wrong about?
Well, again, ask Kenneth. But the Republicans who are releasing the memo, they're going to the criticism, we haven't seen it yet, is that they're going to make it look like it's on this dossier, this unsubstantiated dossier, and that the FBI was getting FISA warrants based on this dossier. Again, unsubstantiated. But the experts who know the FISA courts, they say that would never be enough.
Right.
That there would have to be other underlying evidence that might or might not be supported by the dossier that a judge would have to see before getting the FISA court subpoena. And the critics say that's the part of the story that Nunes has left out of the memo.
Right. So even if this Steele dossier is bogus or inaccurate, and actually it may not be, some of the stuff in the Steele memo has been proven to be true.
Absolutely.
But even if that were proven to be inappropriate or not good enough, there must have been other things that they presented to the FISA judge in order to get that warrant.
And that's what they're saying is highly classified, the way it was retrieved or from whom it was retrieved. And that's why the head of the FBI and the Justice Department have gone to the committee saying, you know, that they, and to the White House saying, we have quote unquote grave reservations about this being released.
But this Nunes guy has rushed to the aid of President Trump before. When the president said that Barack Obama had tapped his phones, Nunes was the guy that led the charge defending that cockamamie assertion.
Well, remember, he ducked away from one of his staffers, ran up to the White House, had a meeting at the White House, and then came back and said he discovered this when Apparently, it was the White House that had given it to him.
So that guy has persuaded all the other people on the committee to release this. That is, all the Republicans. That's all you need. And so they're going to release this information. Then the Democrats said, okay, fine. You got a memo. We got a memo. Chuck Schumer said, I want you to release this memo. And here's 10 pages on our view, which is contrary to yours.
Not Chuck Schumer, but Adam Schiff.
Adam Schiff.
Right.
And based on party line vote, they voted not to release that memo.
And it goes beyond the committee because the speaker appoints the chair of the House Intelligence Committee. It's not like where it's voted on by the other chairman.
Ah.
And so the speaker has great sway here, too. And he's decided, you know, to stay out of it or to support
right.
the release. And a lot of people are surprised by that.
Paul Ryan was asked specifically about this. And specifically, he said, I have nothing specific to say. Okay. So Kenneth Moten from ABC.
This memo is not indictment of the FBI, of the Department of Justice. It does not impugn the Mueller investigation or the Deputy Attorney General.
That's House Speaker Paul Ryan, who spoke a short time ago at the Republican retreat in West Virginia about this memo that may well be released yet today, John Williams.
Says it does not impugn the integrity of the FBI or the Justice Department.
Or the Mueller investigation,
no.
which the people who are arguing against it, saying it was that's the very reason it was written.
Well, what other reason would there be except to send up a red flag to us good American people that the Mueller investigation is suspect? I mean, what's the at least admit it's political.
Well, we haven't seen the memo yet.
Well,
we haven't.
I can't. There's two kinds of things.
The Republican chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee hasn't seen it yet.
You don't need to see the memo to have an editorial comment about it. Don't you know how these things are done?
I think that's true, but
Kenneth Moten joins us now, ABC News in Washington. I suppose you knew that part of the story. Kenneth, welcome to our show.
Thanks, John.
So the Paul Ryan, the party chair, says the Speaker of the House says this does not in any way impugn the integrity of those agencies. What's the spin there? Why is he saying that?
Well, he's saying that because he's read the memo. So I guess he feels that because he's read the memo and that the White House is now reviewing it, that it does not undermine the Russia investigation like Democrats have been saying. But what I do know is that the White House just put out a statement moments ago saying that the president will most likely sign off on this thing tomorrow. But that just kicks the memo back to Congress, and it will actually be up to Congress to literally release it to the public. So they actually said they don't think there are going to be that many redactions after we know that White House Chief of Staff John Kelly has been talking with top FBI career officials the past couple of days about possible redactions and classifications. So at this point, we know that the president most likely will sign off tomorrow, and it maybe early next week the public will actually lay some eyes on that memo.
Congress, meaning the Congressional Committee or the entire body of Congress?
In the House Intelligence Committee. So the one that GOP Chairman Devin Nunes, who's been under fire, is actually in control of.
What is your answer? What is their answer? The answer to why has Nunes authored this memo and why do they want it released to the public?
Well, it's exactly what Paul Ryan just said about an hour ago at that GOP retreat, which is that they're the oversight branch and that if there are alleged abuses within the FBI when it comes to either political bias or abuses of the FISA court, that's the surveillance act that allows them to go get a warrant to surveil, a private U.S. citizen, then they feel like they have the oversight. They have the investigative power to look over any type of alleged abuses.
Who's the they in this? I mean, we have this committee that's doing this investigation of possible collusion. They don't like what they're seeing from the FBI and this FISA court warrant. But what is this oversight you're speaking about?
The oversight would be the agents, the ones who are going to get the warrant, who's involved in the investigation. We heard that even Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, is named in this memo. He's the one who signed off on the FBI agents going to get this warrant as well. So at this point, we just need to see the memo. Who's in it? Who's detailed in it? At this point, we've only been hearing from sources who is named in this memo. We just know that, obviously, with the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee and his staff compiling this memo, we've only heard, you know, general statements about what it says, which is shocking political bias within the FBI, things that were done wrong in the initial stages of the Russia investigation. So at this point, it's we'll see what's in it once it actually is released. But again, there might be redactions. There might be things that the public, including the press, will not see in that memo.
I think I'm comfortable with that. To be honest with you, suppose it is damning and we discovered that the FBI acted badly and that the FISA court should not have issued that warrant, fine. Then don't find any obstruction of justice. Don't find any collusion. I mean, I still don't see the point in all of us weighing in from 30,000 feet on this. No, it wouldn't be 30,000 feet. That's a good overview. We don't really know all of the details of this, and I don't know that this needs to be debated in public. This is my long kind of question here, Kenneth, but shouldn't the committee figure it out themselves? And if they decide that there is no collusion or nothing bad happened, then say as much. I don't see why before they come to a conclusion, they need to tell us these things.
And I would say that just a reminder that this is Washington, that there, believe it or not, politics at play. When you have the president repeatedly saying that the Russia investigation is a hoax, fake news, then you have a GOP chairman, Devin Nunes, who has admitted to working with the White House on certain parts of, for instance, drafts and letting them know things that are happening with the Russia investigation, which is why Democrats have accused the GOP chairman of being too cozy with the White House during the Russia investigation. Then you have a lot of politics at play. And so you've got this memo, and the president of the United States says, I want that memo released.
Yeah.
He was calling a hot mic State of the Union night, you know, telling a Republican lawmaker, don't worry about it, 100% is going to be released. So at this point, we believe it's going to be released.
But if Paul Ryan is saying, don't worry, this doesn't impugn the integrity of the agencies involved, then why would they be releasing it? If everything was status quo and hunky-dory, I don't see why they would want to let us look over their shoulders. That's never happened. Presumably, the reason Nunes is doing this is because he thinks the process has been compromised, and yet there is Paul Ryan saying that this doesn't, you know, weigh negatively on the FBI or Justice Department at all. I don't know how you square those two.
And at this point, Ryan is saying, look, he has faith in the GOP chairman. He believes that the process of even releasing the memo has played out correctly. At this point, you're right. It seems like there are two different things being said by Republicans or top Republicans on this memo. But sometimes, we feel from this is that each Republican reads it, who's laid eyes on it, and then they have their own opinions about, infers what it says about the FBI.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
I get that, yeah. But here's my last question for you, Kenneth, and I'll let you go, and that is, so Nunes, who's in charge of this committee, took it upon himself to just write this summary of his concerns about the way the FISA warrant was issued. Am I correct about that? I mean, there was nobody waiting for him to opine on this. This was just something that he decided he wanted to do. Is that it?
That is correct.
And then it was, okay, now that I've summarized our concerns about this, what do we do with it? And they thought we should let everybody see what our concern is. And that's where we are today.
That is where we are today. And the House Intelligence Committee could have also instead held an investigation, done closed door hearings. But as far as this memo, there are top Republicans, including the president, who say the public needs to see this.
All right, Kenneth Moulton, who writes, reports for ABC in Washington, D.C. So maybe next week, huh?
Maybe next week, early.
Yeah. Kenneth, thanks for your time this afternoon. We sure appreciate it. So, kids, I just saw you walk across Michigan Avenue.
Yes. Getting hydration for the show.
I'm getting conflicting reports about when the memo will be released. Kenneth Moulton from ABC said maybe early next week. CNN thinks maybe tomorrow.
Tomorrow is what I was hearing.
Yeah, I don't know why they would wait.
Tomorrow, yeah. Mm-hmm. The New York Times is reporting that the president will not stand in the way of the release of the memo, which is different than saying he's cleared it or releasing it himself.
Right.
It's a very technical interpretation of this, which is because he has to declassify it.
But he could, that's it, but he could not. I mean, he could keep it from being released.
Correct. Yes. He can maintain its classification, but he will not stand in the way, is the way the White House is saying it. So so it's sort of like, hey, I didn't do it. This was the House. I don't know anything about it. And now we're the other shoe to drop here is Christopher Wray. If the FBI director, who Donald Trump hired after he fired the existing
FBI director.
Thanks for the background.
Or is Wray the director?
Wray is the director.
And he's going to quit, isn't he? Or is he thinking about it?
I believe that you will see him quit when this happens. And then when that happens, then the question is, where are the Republicans who are not just trying to cover for the president politically here? Because that's all that's going on. They're just, it's political cover. And I don't know that Donald Trump or his kids or anybody else would, you know, actively sought out the Russians. But it's clear that the Russians sought them out. And they may have fallen into a couple of holes with the Russians. Even like that meeting that took place in the Trump Tower. Everybody knows that took place. Everybody acknowledges that took place. Did they try to change the story about that taking place? Yes. Everybody knows that all happened. Does that arise to the level of a crime? I don't know. But it would certainly help if the president and his people cooperated and said, yeah, they tried to get us, but I'm not going to let them get us. And by the way, here are the sanctions.
You think he's going to speak to the Mueller? Do you think Trump is going to testify?
No.
He said he can't wait to.
Yeah.
He said
he's going to really say his lawyers to tell him he can't.
Yeah, and that's a funny thing because I want somebody to then say, wait a minute, they could play him this way. Mm-hmm. You're Donald Trump. You're the most powerful man in the world. You're telling me some underling lawyer is going to tell you what to do?
Yeah, he's not that dumb. And it doesn't matter because the people who want what Donald Trump is selling don't care. They just want him to be successful. I think in their heart of hearts, they get that there's something wacky here, but it's not something anybody else didn't ever do and is better than Hillary. So let's go. I think it's the way they look at it.
So if he went to that committee and lied or perjured, well, then he might actually get in trouble. But they don't care, you're saying, what he would say to Mueller. He still
they don't even care if he perjured himself. Everybody has to do it. It's more important that he stands up for, you know, fill in the blank of whatever they're interested in.
Lester Holt joining you today?
Lester Holt will be here. Also, we're going to get the Washington Post take on this. The guy who's covering the Christopher Wray side of this is going to join us at 3:40 as well. And Tom Skilling will be here right at the top to tell us whether or not we should cover our rabbits tonight.
Yeah, I'm going to get out of the way because it's getting colder as we speak.
Seriously dropping by the minute.
Man.
It's the surface of Mars.